Well, turn back if you would to Acts chapter 18 as we look at this chapter, or the first half of this chapter together this morning. Paul was at rock bottom. Perhaps it doesn't come across quite if we just read this a little bit. There are some clues of it, but particularly if we think of what happened before, which we'll recap in a moment. Paul is at rock bottom. He's very discouraged. There are some question marks as to will he actually carry on. God has to appear to him in a vision. Tell him not to fear. Tell him to speak. Paul probably didn't need any encouragement, we might think, to speak. But he did. He needed God to come and tell him in a dream to speak. Paul was afraid. Paul was struggling. Paul was discouraged. He didn't know whether he would carry on. We'll look at some of the reasons behind that in a moment. And we'll look at what God did and how God and the help of his people encouraged Paul to carry on. And we're going to look at it in two ways this morning. There's two titles for the sermon. And two ways I think we can apply this. First, you could take the title, Keeping Going as God's Servants. If you're a Christian here this morning, then I hope you know that you're one of God's servants. Yes, you're one of his children. Yes, you're forgiven by him. Yes, you've been given great privileges. But yes, you've also been given a task to help him and serve his kingdom. As I hope there's ways that you are serving the king and following him. How do we keep going as God's servants? How do you keep going in whatever it is that you seek to do for the glory of God? There's a sense in which we can do everything for that. Whether we eat or drink, whatever we do with our lives, we should do it for the glory of God. We serve him all the time. We serve him in the home. We serve him in our workplaces. But when we're doing specific things with that specific sole purpose of doing it for the Lord, how do we keep going in those things? Whether that's teaching in the Sunday school, whether that's taking part in one of the outreaches, whether that's using gifts of hospitality, using gifts of being able to teach, using gifts of being able to encourage and come alongside people one-on-one. Whatever are those gifts that God has given us to use for his kingdom, however we're serving him as his servants, how do we keep going? Because it's easy perhaps to start it. Sometimes it's harder to carry on. There are all sorts of discouragements. We'll look at some of those in a moment. All sorts of temptations. How do we keep going as God's servants? That's one way we're going to think about it. But there's another way as well. Keeping God's servants going. So we can think about it for ourselves. How do we keep going as God's servants? But look around you. Look around you at other servants of God. Think of somebody else in the hall or in your own church, wherever you come from. Think of somebody else who's serving God faithfully. How can you help them keep going? So think about it in two different ways. How do we keep going ourselves? And how do we help others? How do we help other people who are serving the Lord to keep going? Because that's one of the functions we have together, isn't it? For instance, in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 11, we read this. He gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers for the equipping of the saints for works of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God. He's given some to, for these different jobs, to equip all the saints for works of service. And so perhaps one of the jobs of being a pastor teacher is to equip other believers to serve him, to keep them going, and vice versa. How do we keep each other going as God's servants? Here, Paul was very discouraged, as we said already. Things had been quite tough on this second missionary journey, and Paul had been suffering for the gospel. He'd had great hostility and ridicule, great apathy, great problems in the things that happened of late. And so I'm just going to show you, just recap, that's Paul's first missionary journey. We looked at it a little while back. And then Paul sets off again on a second missionary journey, heads a similar way to before, to go back to some of the churches he'd visited on his previous journey in Derby and Iconium and Antioch and the like. And then on his second journey, he heads on to Troas. He has this vision of the man from Macedonia, come over to Macedonia and help us. And so they do that. They cross over to Philippi. There in Philippi, there's Lydia, who's saved down by the riverside, a slave girl who's delivered from a demon, but they're put in prison. They're beaten. They're locked up in the inner cell. Sure, there's a miraculous escape later on, but still then the authorities ask them to leave the city. And so they head on their way. They head on to Thessalonica. And we read there in chapter 17 how the Jews again tried to seize them. And Paul and Silas had to escape by night and leave that city. So they went down the road not far to Berea. And again, there's people there who want to listen to the gospel. There's people, it seems, who are saved. But again, trouble is stirred up by the crowds. Paul has to leave. Silas and Timothy stay a bit longer there in Berea. But Paul has to head on his way again. He heads on this time to Athens, end of Acts chapter 17. And there's more trouble. More trouble from the crowds, more hostility. And Paul preaches this magnificent sermon, end of Acts chapter 17. This one of the only sermons that's recorded of preaching the gospel to Gentiles. And Paul preaches this magnificent sermon, and we hear at the end that two people are saved. But the majority of people mock him. They mock him, they ridicule him for the things he was saying. Paul was meeting apathy and indifference. Most of them didn't care less. Most of them thought, oh, what's this babbler trying to say? They ridiculed him, they insulted him. And it seems that Paul didn't stay long in Athens, but headed on instead to Corinth. Paul had been through some tough times in the last stages of his journey. Paul, as we said, was at rock bottom. He was finding it very difficult to carry on. He was suffering for the gospel. He'd been mocked, he'd been insulted, he'd been beaten, possibly within an inch of his life. And there was a concern, would Paul actually carry on in this journey? Here he is in Corinth, and he's really struggling. He's been through the ringer, we might say. He's had one hardship after another. One difficulty after another. Violence, anger, crowds being stirred up against him. He's been before the authorities several times, asked to leave several different cities. He'd been preaching his heart out and had very little to show for it. Paul was suffering for the sake of the gospel. But there were more ordinary trials as well. There were these long journeys that he'd been on. The tiredness, possibly sickness, it seems to be implied in some of the other letters that he wrote. One wonders perhaps whether he'd even recovered from the savage beating he got in Philippi. In those times when people would be beaten with rods, your back would be a mess, bleeding, wounded, down to the muscles and bones. You know, it would take you ages to recover from that. And yet Paul has to carry on the journey. Was he still going through great pain through those things? Great suffering. Paul summarizes a little bit in his second letter to the Corinthians, these people he's now with in the city of Corinth, and in 2 Corinthians, chapter 11, he tells them a bit of these things. Verse 24, from the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one, 3 times I was beaten with rods, once I was stoned, 3 times I was shipwrecked, a night and day I've been in the sea, in journeys often, in perils of waters, perils of robbers, perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in peril in the city, in peril in the wilderness, in peril on the sea, in peril among false brethren, in weariness and toil, sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, cold and nakedness. Interestingly, he adds one more to the list. And besides all these other things, what comes upon me daily? My deep concern for the churches. All these sufferings he'd gone through, all of these ordinary things perhaps of being on such a long journey and so on. And he says, even more than that, the burden that's on me for my churches, for the churches, the concern he had for them, it weighed even heavier upon him than all these other sufferings he'd been through. Perhaps he had a particular burden here as he comes to Corinth in Acts chapter 18 for those people he'd left behind. Was he concerned how Lydia and the slave girl and the jailer were doing in Philippi, this tiny church he'd had to leave behind? Was he concerned for them? Was he concerned for the people in Berea and Thessalonica and the couple of people who'd believed in Athens? Was he had a great burden because he couldn't help them? He was too far away. And his presence there seemed to cause more trouble. That burden he had for these churches and the people, perhaps, he'd left behind as well. So Paul had these difficulties, the suffering he was going through, ordinary troubles, the burden, he says, of the ministry. I wonder too whether Paul was struggling sometimes with loneliness. We mentioned before in Acts chapter 17 that Silas and Timothy stayed on in Berea and Paul went to Athens. And we read in Acts 17 and verse 16 that he asked for Silas and Timothy to catch him up. But it seems either they didn't catch him up fast enough or he left Athens before they did. So they only catch up with him later on in Corinth, chapter 18 and verse 5. And so it seems for a while Paul's on his own, it seems. He leaves Athens, he heads on to Corinth. I wonder whether he had another burden on him, and that was that of loneliness, isolation, trying to carry on, but without Silas and Timothy, these key helpers. I wonder as well whether Paul was struggling financially. It says in verse 3 that he was now staying with Priscilla and Aquila and he was working with them, for they were tent makers as well. We'll come back to that a little bit more later on, but I wonder whether the implication of that perhaps is he was strapped for cash, whether he couldn't really carry on in the ministry full time because he didn't have the money to do it. Didn't have the resources to do it. In 1 Corinthians chapter 2, he tells the Corinthian church again of how things began there. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, "And brethren, when I came to you, I didn't come with excellence of speech or wisdom, declaring to you the testimony of God, for I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I was with you in weakness, in fear, and in much trembling." That's what Paul says. His initial days were in Corinth. Days of fear and trembling. It says in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 8, a similar sort of recap. "We do not want you to be ignorant, brothers, of the trouble which came to us in Asia, and that we were burdened beyond measure, above life, so we even despaired of life." That's how Paul recaps his journey to them. He arrived in Corinth at rock bottom, despairing even of life, struggling so much, filled with fear and trembling. That's how it was for Paul. And then he was in Corinth. Actually, here in Acts 18, it gives us very little, really, of what that was like. But actually, we get much more of it later on from some of our other things they said, and especially in the letters. Corinth was a completely immoral place. Corinth was one vast red light district. The whole city was. It was renowned for it throughout the ancient world. People used it as a form of slang. You know, when some politician or other was caught doing something inappropriate, they go, "Wow, he's been caught doing it Corinthian." You know, it was that sort of slander. It was that sort of innuendo. Corinth was the word for it. Immorality. That's how people talked of it. There in the middle of Corinth was the Temple of Venus. And this temple employed thousands of prostitutes. And every evening, they would come down from the temple to ply their trade. It was said in worship of their god. There was Paul living in that kind of place. Did he see all those things going on? Did he suffer with the temptations of it? Did he suffer too to see the kind of things that were going on? Later on he writes Romans chapter 1. Most people think he wrote Romans when he was in Corinth. Possibly not this time, but a later time. But Paul probably wrote Romans while in Corinth. And so when he writes in Romans chapter 1 about the people who dishonour their bodies and degrade themselves, who do unnatural things, who have a debased mind. He was thinking of Corinth. Corinth was the place in the world that summed that up more than anything else. There was the pressure of living in such an ungodly city. The temptations, the way it must have just frustrated him. We read in Acts 17 and verse 16 that when he was in Athens, he was provoked by the idolatry. So his spirit was stirred up within him. And probably the same sort of thing, but for a different reason in Corinth. His spirit was all provoked within him, unrest, unsettled. He couldn't relax there. Because he knew what a hostile place it was, what an ungodly place it was, what a place it was that was controlled by Satan. Not so much through idolatry, but through an immorality there in Corinth. And then one more thing that weighed heavily upon Paul, I think, was a fear for the future. As we said already, he'd been through a fairly predictable pattern of events in the last four places he's been to. Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, and Athens. Every time he's gone to somewhere new, he's preached the gospel. Some people have listened, and crowds haven't. Crowds have stirred up trouble, and he's ended up in prison, ended up being thrown out, ended up having to leave. It's happened four times in a row in the last four places. I wonder whether Paul was just prepared for the same thing to happen again. It tells us in verse 4 that he reasoned in the synagogue and persuaded both Jews and Greeks. That's a little bit of a positive translation. You could probably, it's better translated, tried to persuade Jews and Greeks. Doesn't say he was actually successful. He tried. He was striving to persuade them. But he tells us in verse 6, they opposed him and blasphemed. They opposed him. The literal translation is they set themselves up for a war. Here was Paul trying to persuade them about Christ, and they were so hostile to it, they were bunkering down, as it were, ready for a fight. They didn't want to listen. They wanted to fight verbally, fight in terms of throwing insults. As it says, they blasphemed him. But was we fight in a violent sense as well? Paul was struggling. And so Paul says to them, your blood be upon your own heads. I'm clean. I'm going to the Gentiles. He gives that stern condemnation to them. But a difficult thing to do. He only actually goes, as it were, next door in the end, to the next house along the road. He hasn't gone far from them. He still wants to give them the opportunity to listen. Then we'd read in verse 8 that Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believes, and his household. Great news, you might think. But does Paul go to bed that evening thinking, oh no, now we're for it? This influential man, the leader of the synagogue, has turned over to the Christians. He's joined their side. What's the rest of the synagogue going to think? What's the rest of the Jews going to do? Did Paul go to bed that night with a heavy heart, thinking we're for it? Because God comes to speak to him in a dream, doesn't he? Of course, we read later in the chapter, in verse 40, verse 12, that the Jews do try to have him arrested. They bring him before the judgment seat of this man called Gallio. They want him silenced. They want him exiled from the province. That shows that he was kind of right. That was their plan. But that night, God speaks to him in a dream, verse 9, and says, do not be afraid. Which means, of course, Paul was afraid. Otherwise, why would God say it? And God says to him in a dream, speak. Don't be silent. And why else would God say that except Paul was afraid and was too scared to speak? How can we often feel like that too? Keeping going as God's servants. Sometimes we can feel like we've been through the ringer, that every time we've tried to open our mouth in our workplace, every time we've tried to talk to some loved one about the Lord Jesus, we've been met with another insult. Just shut down. No, no, shut up. I don't want you talking about that. And we just think, what's the point? I just don't know if I can be bothered to talk about it one more time to that brother or sister or mum or dad or whoever it is we're trying to witness to. I don't know if I can carry on. I'm just going to give up for a bit. We can all struggle in those same ways, can't we? We can be afraid. We can be silent. We can struggle to keep going through one or more of these things that Paul was suffering with. Whether that's being oppressed with temptation, feeling weighed down with great burdens that are on our minds. Sometimes we can too be afraid for things we think might happen. Paul was afraid of what would happen in Corinth. He thinks it's bound to happen. Of course I'm going to get arrested. Of course I'm going to be thrown out. That's the kind of thing he was expecting. We can be afraid, can't we, of what we think in our imaginations is going to happen next. And Paul's not the only one. There's not time this morning but to look at other examples of Jeremiah and Joshua, Moses and Elijah in the Old Testament, who all went through similar troubles and struggled to carry on going. How do we keep going? Here are some of the discouragements that Paul faced. Well, how did God help him? How did God and his people encourage Paul to keep going? We said before, Paul seemed quite isolated. And yet he came to Corinth, we're told in verse 1. And there he found a Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, and his wife Priscilla. They were refugees, it seemed. They'd been kicked out of Rome, and they'd come now to live in Corinth. Somewhere along the time, they'd become Christians too. So they were Jews who'd become believers. We don't exactly know when that happened. And Paul comes to stay with them. How did God and his people help Paul carry on? But the first one, through partnership. I think before, Paul was feeling very isolated, especially in Athens. He sent for Silas and Timothy, but it seems they didn't catch him up in time, or Paul went on too quickly. Paul was on his own. But here he finds some other friends, Priscilla and Aquila, Jews who've been converted, and they welcome him into their home. They even give him some opportunities to work in their business and earn some money. Later on in chapter 18, we see Priscilla and Aquila helping a man called Apollos. Later on, they're mentioned in some of the letters because they're the people who are hosting the church in its meetings together. Partnership in the gospel. How could Paul carry on? I think on his own, he might not have done. But with Priscilla and Aquila coming alongside him, God sent his people and God's people themselves anxious to help. And they came alongside Paul at just the right moment to give him a home, give him some support, and help him carry on. It tells us in the book of Romans and chapter 16 a little bit more about this pair. Romans 16 and verse 3. Greet Priscilla and Aquila, my fellow workers in Christ Jesus, who risked their own necks for my life, to whom not only I give thanks, but all the churches of the Gentiles. Likewise, greet the church that meets in their house. Very little we're told about this husband and wife, Priscilla and Aquila. There they were, serving the Lord, serving Paul, helping Paul carry on going. That was their concern. And a great concern, he says, for all the churches in that area too. Even hosting a church in their own house. They risked their necks, says Paul, for the gospel. And they were his fellow workers. How do God and his people help God's servants carry on? Through partnership. And then we're told later on in Acts 18 and verse 5, when Silas and Timothy had come from Macedonia, Paul was compelled by the Spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus is the Christ. Some more partners turn up. Silas and Timothy, he's been with them for a long time now through his journey, but they'd been left behind in Macedonia, Berea and places like that. Now finally they caught him up in Corinth. And it seems that their arrival breathes a breath of fresh air, doesn't it, to Paul? Silas and Timothy arrive and Paul is compelled to go and proclaim. Was he hesitating before? Did his feet feel like lead? Could he really struggle to get himself going and carrying on that ministry? And then Silas and Timothy arrive and he's compelled to do it. Just them being with him gives him greater enthusiasm, greater encouragement to carry on. How can we keep going as God's servants? Well, we need partners. Partners who are going to help us. And how can we keep others of God's servants going? But by being partners with them. As he said, look around you. Think of other people in the church who are serving God in one way or another. On their own, they're really going to struggle. But coming alongside them, that's how God and his people keep his servants going. That's how we can do it. How we can encourage each other. You know what it's like if you ever tried to go out talking to somebody about the Lord, or when we've done one of our outreach or something, and you just feel a bit, there we go, your leaflets to invite people to church or whatever it is, and you just feel a bit alone and outnumbered there in the town square or whatever it is. But as a group, it's much easier to do it, isn't it? Because you encourage each other. Why don't you give each other a nudge? Come on, let's do this. Let's pray, let's go. Together, partners in the gospel, we can carry on going easier, can't we? As well as partnership through provision. As Silas and Timothy come from Macedonia, verse 5, and Paul can carry on going. There as he's greeted by his friends who he's been missing for some time. It tells us in 1 Thessalonians what their arrival was like. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 6, we read this. I'm in 2 Thessalonians. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 6. But now that Timothy's come to us from you and brought us good news of your faith and love, that you always have good remembrance of us, greatly desiring to see us as we also to see you. Therefore, brethren, in all our affliction and distress, we were comforted concerning you by your faith. For now we live, if you stand fast in the Lord. Timothy came with news from Thessalonica, here in Acts, as referred to in the letter to 1 Thessalonians. And Timothy comes with good news. And Paul says, in all our distress, we were comforted because we heard of your faith down the road in Thessalonica. And now we live, he says. Remember what he said before in 1 Corinthians? We feel like we were going to die. He says, now I feel alive. Because he heard this encouraging message of what was going on in Thessalonica. They were provided for by example and encouragement to carry on going. And so that is a great help, isn't it, to God's servants. And how we can help other of God people carrying on, by us carrying on, by us being an example. You may not know, we were talking on a Thursday about the character from Pilgrim's Progress, Help, who lifts Christian out of the slough of despond. And we said we should make it our aim, whenever we're with God's people, that we would be a help. And we don't know how. We might not know exactly how that prayer might be fulfilled. But if that's our desire, then God will answer it. And we might never know the encouragement we are to somebody else. But how God's people provide that encouragement to carry on. That's what we need to do, isn't it? And so it is. Think of our missionary friends. And they're like that, a bit isolated from us on the other side of the world or something like that. But as we just share with them news, as we tell them we're praying for you, we encourage them to carry on going, even though we might be far removed from them geographically. We provide for them in that sort of way. And I think of provision as well in financial things. We read as well in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 9 that indeed when I was present with you in Corinth and in need I was a burden to no one, for what I lacked, the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied. And in everything, I kept myself from being a burden to you. It seems when these people from Macedonia, Silas and Timothy, arrived, they brought a gift. It seems the church in Corinth was a little bit reluctant, or perhaps there weren't very many of them, to provide for Paul's needs. That's why I sort of suggest he's working as a tent maker, because he hasn't got much money. And yet Silas and Timothy arrive with provision for him. Same in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 15. Now you Philippians know that in the beginning of the gospel, when I departed from Macedonia, no church shared with me concerning giving and receiving, but you only. For even in Thessalonica, you sent aid to me again and again. It was the churches down the road who were supporting Paul there in Corinth. How did God and his people help Paul carry on? But by partnering with him and providing for him. And so we have a responsibility, don't we, to help God's servants carry on. Think of other people who are serving God in our church. How can we help them keep going? And then God came to him with a message. It's there in verses 9 and 10. The Lord spoke to Paul in the night by a vision. Do not be afraid, but speak, and do not keep silent, for I am with you. And no one will attack you to hurt you, for I have many people in this city. God came and spoke to him. God directly spoke to Paul in this great time of need, in this vision. Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. What a wonderful message that was. You might think somebody like Paul doesn't need it, but God thought he did. Sometimes we read about Paul and think he seems this unstoppable machine that just goes on and trailblazing his way across Europe. But he's not. He's human. He's struggling. And he's afraid. That's why Paul comes and says to him, don't be afraid. That's why God says to him, don't be afraid. And Paul, of course, echoes these words to others, doesn't he? In lots of his letters, especially to Timothy. He'd write later on to Timothy, God hasn't given us a spirit of timidity, but of power. He says to Timothy, you carry on going. Paul would echo these words that he'd received from God to encourage him, to encourage others. God tells him, speak and do not be silent. Again, we think that's a funny thing to say to Paul. He seems to need no encouragement to open his mouth and start talking. But God says, speak. Perhaps Paul was reluctant. Perhaps Paul was afraid of the consequences. And God comes to encourage him. Speak, don't be silent. And again, doesn't Paul echo that later on to people like Timothy? Be prepared in season, out season. Preach the word. Keep going. Paul passes on those encouragements. Be faithful, God tells him. Carry on. Just keep going a bit longer. In some ways, a very predictable message, isn't it? And some of these things are classics, aren't they? The things that God says to Paul. The next thing he says, I am with you. That'd be an interesting exercise at some point when you've got a Sunday afternoon. See if you can find out how many times in the Bible God ever says to somebody, I am with you. And it must run to loads, mustn't it? I am with you. It's a classic phrase, isn't it, from God? That here he says to Paul, I am with you. But that's what Paul needed to be reminded of in his discouragement. And what a promise. Even it is a promise that's been repeated many times before. He's told it again. Carry on. I am with you. In that wonderful promise, the last words, some of the last words that Jesus says to his disciples here on earth. I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Isn't that what we need to remember? When we're discouraged, when we're struggling to carry on serving God, that he is with us. It was John Wesley's last words. As John Wesley was on his deathbed, they were all quite surprised. He seems to be sort of fading away. And then he plucked up strength to say his last thing. The best thing, he said, is that God is with us. Then he breathed his last. The best thing, he said, is God is with us. We're going to sing in a few minutes to close our time. Oh, the deep, deep love of Jesus. The love that's all around me. Underneath me, over me, the love that's around me. I am with you, says God. Surrounding us with his great love. Don't we need to have that encouragement to keep going? To be reminded of that great, deep, deep love of Jesus. God says to him, verse 10, I am with you and no one will hurt you. No one will hurt you. There's a specific promise in many ways to Paul in that situation that no harm would come to him in Corinth. And it does come true. Even though he's arrested a couple of verses later, he's brought before this man, Gallio. The Jews want him thrown out. But no one harms him, just as God said. No one harms Paul in Corinth. He stays there in the end for 18 months. That's one of his longest stays anywhere. He stays there for 18 months. The Jews try and arrest him, try and have him thrown out. But he's given an opportunity by the governor to stay there for some time. No one will hurt you. Do we have that same promise? Not exactly. It was a specific thing. No one will hurt you in Corinth, said God. Of course, they would in other places down the road. And it tells us at the end of the verses about a man called Sosthenes. He is beaten up in Corinth. He's probably the same person who's mentioned in 1 Corinthians. So no harm would come to Paul in Corinth was a very specific instruction. Paul, of course, was later on martyred. But there is a sense in which that is a promise for everyone. No harm will come to you because we're safe in his hands. Even when Paul was years later in Rome, did he know that God was with him and that no harm would come to him? Even when Emperor Nero sent the executioner to his door? Was it still the same promise that no one would harm him because he was safe with Jesus? Even when Nero's executioners put him to death. And that promise is for us, isn't it? I am with you. No one will hurt you. That's not a promise that we'll never have to go and see the doctor, that we'll never have to go to A&E or whatever. Nor that anyone will ever be unkind to us or aggressive to us as we seek to serve the Lord. No, but he is with us all the same. And no harm will come to us. No real harm. Because we're with him. We're safe in his hands. And the last thing God says to him is, I've got many people here in Corinth. God had chosen many people, and they're my people, he says, in Corinth. Even though at that moment they were not listening, and they were probably as immoral as the rest, God says, they're my people. They just don't know it yet. I've chosen them and they are going to believe and they are going to follow me. It's just news to them. I've got a plan. I've got it sorted. And so God says to Paul, carry on. Serve me here in Corinth. And so Paul does. He stays there 18 months. We read in the letters of 1 and 2 Corinthians about the consequences of that. Of how there were many people who were saved, even from that immoral, ungodly place. God is in charge. And so serving him is not a pointless exercise. Now, we don't know who he's chosen in Ashbourne. We don't know whether he has many he's chosen here. We've got no idea. In a sense, many is a rather vague word even for Paul to go on. We've no idea who God has chosen. We've no idea on the quantity. But God's in charge. How do we keep going as God's servants with that certain knowledge that he's with us? That we're safe in his hands and it's his kingdom he's building. In a sense, we're just along to do a little bit of the work along the way. God has chosen people in this city. God has chosen people here in Ashbourne. They're his people. They just don't know it yet. But they're the ones that he's loved and he's died for, and they are going to believe. They are going to hear. And God sends Paul out with that certain promise of his election. And that should give Paul great stimulus for evangelism, to encourage him. That Paul is not going out there to convert people. God's doing that. It's not Paul's job to make them born again. The Spirit's going to do that. Paul needs to focus on what is his task, to speak faithfully. And do we need that encouragement too? And do we need that clarification too as we serve the Lord? That it's not us being sent out there to convert people or make them born again or whatever. That's God's job. We need to do our job of speaking and go out encouraged that he's going before us, that he's at work calling his people. He knows all about them. He knows who they are. And he can't go wrong. As Jesus said, all the Father's given to me will come to me. Not one will be lost. And that's our great encouragement, isn't it, to carry on the work here in Ashbourne or any other place that you may be. Because God is calling people. And that's our encouragement to carry on. keeping going as God's servants, we need to keep those things in mind. Don't fear. God is with us. Speak. Carry on. We're safe in his hands. And he's the one who's in charge of this. He's the one who's overruling it all as well. And as we said, how do we keep others going? By partnering with them, providing for them, encouraging them in whatever way we can. Reminding them of these same things that even Paul needed a reminder of. And if the great apostle needed to be reminded about those simple things, how many times do me and you need to be reminded of those same things? So let's sing together our last hymn. It's number 170, if you want to follow it in the hymn books. And we've referred to it a little bit already, haven't we? The deep, deep love of Jesus. That's how we carry on serving him, in that knowledge that he's with us, that we're safe in his hands, safe in his love. Oh, the deep, deep love of Jesus, vast, unmeasured, boundless, free. Let's stand and sing together.